Brexit means Brexit.
Brexit is unumstossbar.
Rocket Man should have been handled a long time ago. He's fired!
Au nom du peuple français!
Wir schaffen das.
Make our planet great again.
Don't worry, be happy.
I will kill you if you destroy my country.
Better is always possible.
Let's do this!
I ain't spending any time on it.
Hello, I'm Brett Mason in the gallery for SBS World News. Extraordinary, the one word I've heard time and time again here in the corridors of power, as if the stubborn standoff between Malcolm Turnbull and his embattled deputy Barnaby Joyce wasn't enough drama, this week's guest is encouraging backbenchers to find their backbones.
If you choose to defy the whip, be proud of that, embrace that, because as a backbencher, you have considerable influence, particularly if you're a slightly grumpy one and prepared to stand up and be counted on issues that genuinely matter to you.
Nick Dubois, the former British parliamentarian and author of Confessions of a Recovering MP in a moment. But first, here's our political reporter Maria Zivic with a look back at a wild week in the Bush capital.
Thanks, Brett. Well, the private affairs of Barnaby Joyce have become increasingly public this week. The snowballing fallout over the Deputy Prime Minister's affair with a former staffer who's now pregnant with his child forced him to publicly apologise to his wife of 24 years.
I would like to say to Natalie how deeply sorry I am for all the hurt this has caused. To my girls, how deeply sorry I am for all the hurt that it has caused them. To Vicky Campion, how deeply sorry I am that she has been dragged into this.
The government too has been dragged in with a question time battering every day this week led by opposition leader Bill Shorten.
Does the Prime Minister have complete confidence that the Deputy Prime Minister's allocation of staffing positions meets the high standards expected of his ministers?
After being under siege for days, Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull took a stand, although it came just as the parliamentary week was wrapping up.
Barnaby made a shocking error of judgment in having an affair with a young woman working in his office. In doing so, he has set off a world of woe for those women and appalled all of us.
He stopped short of sacking his deputy but promised to set a new standard by banning sex between ministers and their staff. He's left the ultimate decision on Barnaby Joyce's future to the man himself, but has taken away one of his deputy's usual duties. Finance Minister Matthias Cormann will be acting Prime Minister when Mr Turnbull flies to Washington for an official visit next week. Mr Turnbull's confirmed Mr Joyce will be taking personal leave instead.
In regards comments by the Prime Minister yesterday at his press conference, I have to say that in many instances they caused further harm. I believe they were in many instances inept and most definitely in many instances unnecessary. I'll go on by saying that I would not wish on friend nor foe the hurt, the scrutiny, the intense intrusion into your lives that I've gone through this process. I would not wish that on friend nor foe.
This is an absolute full-blown political crisis. Mr Turnbull must sack Mr Joyce. Mr Joyce has said that Mr Turnbull is inept. If the number two in the government thinks that the number one in the government is inept, well, we've got a problem.
The whole affair's rattled the coalition and distracted from its agenda, not to mention taking the spotlight away from significant milestones like the 10-year anniversary of the apology to the survivors of the Stolen Generations. Survivor Florence Onus reflected on it at an event inside Parliament's Great Hall.
It was a moment of truth-telling, which is so important when you're trying to move forward. And it felt as though the nation understood the need to right the wrongs of the past.
The man who made the apology, former Prime Minister Kevin Rudd, was also back on familiar ground to mark the occasion.
I'm often deeply moved by the stories I hear of people who'd been waiting for decades for someone simply to say, sorry, we really screwed you.
He says it's time for the government to seriously consider giving Indigenous Australians a voice to Parliament, as recommended by Indigenous leaders at last year's Uluru Summit. For now, though, the Turnbull government maintains that won't happen. The coalition will enjoy a short reprieve from the daily battles within the parliamentary chambers. Parliament doesn't sit again until late this month.
Leaving that salacious scandal to one side and focusing, shock horror, on some politics now, have you ever wondered what life is really like for a backbench MP in a marginal seat faced with the constant threat of voter rejection? Today's guest knows that feeling all too well. After failing to win a seat in the British Parliament in 2001 and 2005, Tory Nick Dubois finally won the seat of Enfield North in 2010, only to be turfed out at the next election. Ironically, that was when David Cameron won an unexpected Conservative majority. He tried and failed to win the seat back again in last year's disastrous early election called by newly installed British Prime Minister Theresa May. I caught up with Nick in London to find out if he's surprised as the rest of us that she's still Prime Minister.
Well, I thought she would survive because, as you know, I was secretary of what we call the 1922 committee in the Conservative Party. That was formed, obviously, in 1923, but we called it the 1922 committee. It is the trade union of backbenchers. And the backbench chairman of the 1922 committee, his colleagues and the backbenchers wanted to keep Theresa May in office, and they did. It was their support that ensured she didn't have a rapid exit. It was her commitment to see Brexit through, where there was at the time considerable doubt about whether any alternative leader would do the job as thoroughly. So I wasn't surprised. Now, how long she'll be there? Well, you know, in an age when we shouldn't be making forecasts, I think she will see this through till at least 2020, if not the next election. Brexit, I think, will happen because by October of this year, we're going to have the outline of a deal with the EU, or we will have no deal at all. What I couldn't put a lot of money on is whether, in fact, the deal that is struck will be put back to the British people. There is a chance that Parliament could end up doing that. Now, I don't think it's a good idea, but I'm not frightened of democracy. If that is what happens, then anything's up for grabs.
OK, let's rewind. It's May 2010. You're a freshly minted backbench MP. It's your first day in Parliament. We have a very glamorous idea of what life as a parliamentarian is like. What's the reality?
Oh, it's quite brutal, really, and much like going back to school. You know, you get no training in the job. No one tells you how to be an MP. You just turn up. And the first thing I was shown by what we call the doormen, and the doormen are the amazingly dressed, hugely knowledgeable individuals about the House of Commons. And the first thing I'm offered is a tour with one of the doormen. Where does he take me? Just like that first day at school, to show me where to hang my coat. And when I'm in the cloakroom, I see not my name on the peg, but my constituency name, which is a brutal reminder again that you will not be here for very long, and it's the constituency that survives, not the member.
You were telling me that during your time in Parliament, you suffered from MAD. You are a mad backbencher. What does that mean?
Well, I discovered this condition, but as you said in your introduction, I had a very narrow, utterly pathetic majority of 1,692 votes. That was like 1%. So I knew my future hung on a thread. And this is a marginal seat. That's what we mean. So mad was this condition that governed me and many other MPs. Marginal agitation and despair. It means just about every decision you make is seen through the prism of, will that earn me a few votes? Will that keep me a few votes? So some days you would get an invitation to the most obscure event, and by the end of the day, you would have convinced yourself by not going to that event, the person who hosted it will have a committee of 10 people. Those 10 people will be really cross you're not there. They will tell their wives, their partners, their husbands, and then you suddenly got 20 people. They'll tell their friends, probably the local news agent, and suddenly all you see by the end of the evening is your majority disappearing because you did not go and open the local fete with jam tarts and all.
So what's the antidote for mad disorder?
Well, the interesting thing is there is this huge disconnect, because actually, when you're an MP, you're a legislator. You're only there to go in the lobbies and vote as the government want you to, normally, unless, like me, you become an occasional rebel. But you don't have executive power. You don't have the power to order anyone to do anything. And, of course, all your constituents think that's exactly what you are there to do, and you have the power to do it, whether it's fix their plumbing. In the case of Mrs. Jennings, as she famously came into my office, threw open a tin of meat at me, put my nose in it and said, "There's no meat in that tin. Do something about it." Whatever their expectation of you, it is inevitable that you will actually struggle to fulfill it. So you make up for that by trying to show you have influence. And influence is driven by how many ministers come and visit you. And I had loads, by the way. Didn't do me any good because I got kicked out at the next election. But it is creating that impression of your closeness to power, when in reality, unless you are a serial networker, you're not on the instant quick dial of most of the cabinet.
Well, that puts you in a very awkward position, doesn't it? Because you need to keep those constituents on side, but you also need to toe the party line. Is that how you became an accidental Tory party rebel?
Well, I never planned to rebel, and then some...
That's what a rebel would say, though, wouldn't they?
Well, yeah, you're probably right. But some idiot came up with this plan in the first 6 months that we'd been elected, at a time when we were telling everyone that we were going to make cuts, that we had to reduce the annual budget deficit. They came up with this plan: we increase what we pay to the supranational level, i.e. the European Union, and increase their budget. Now, this would have gone down like a huge, nasty disease with anyone in my constituency at the thought that I was going to vote to increase money to Europeans, gosh, dare I say it, foreigners, or... whilst cutting their housing allowance and their children benefit. So I chose to rebel on this, which brought me into confrontation with the whips, but I thought would do me a heap of good in the constituency. And of course, the whips, they're just other MPs who've got this job to whip you into line. The problem is, if you want to be a minister, if you want to be promoted and become the very senior minister for paperclips or whatever it may be, you have to do what they say. Otherwise, you're in the black book and you're in trouble. If, like me, you're a grumpy old something over 50 and you're kind of more concerned about keeping your seat in Parliament than whether you're the minister for paperclips, they don't actually have any power over you. But it is an amazing journey, the whole day they spend trying to get you, and that's what I cover in the book, to vote their way.
How do they do that? What's the secret to being a good whip?
Well, they try charm. They try gentle intimidation. I think they try outright threats, but they never physically assault you, as used to happen in the early 90s.
Unless you're in UKIP, allegedly.
Well, allegedly. I mean, back in the 92, 93, you heard stories about whips crying and MPs crying, and I'm thinking, well, that's pathetic. That really is. So none of that ever happened to me. But I'm 6'4", and the particular whip who was trying to lecture me, the senior whip at the time, he was about, 5'6". So it always stood to my advantage. But having said that, as you well know, I was also had a job offer made to me on the grounds I did not ask David Cameron, the Prime Minister at the time, a particularly tricky question in Prime Minister's questions. And as it happened, it was over a hospital. It was over the death of someone at a hospital. And I said, I'm going to ask this question come what may. And they withdrew the job offer. So bribery, patronage, the odd threat, it's all there. And you just have to be kind of begrudgingly say, in the main, it works.
So given all of that, do you think that it's a system that's a little outdated? Do you think that it actually does what it's meant to do and it does what constituents expect it to do?
Actually, the brutal reality is there are a lot of processes that to the outsider are antiquated and bonkers. So, for example, we don't vote digitally. We have to go through a lobby. We then wait in that lobby for up to 8 minutes. No one else is there, just MPs. And then you go out and you're marked off manually. That sounds really antiquated and expensive. But if you introduce digital voting, you would lose the opportunity of a grumpy old backbencher like me being able to stand right next to the Prime Minister, pin him up against the wall and say, "Oi, you promised to do this, you haven't done this, or whatever.
And you actually did that.
Yes. His job, David Cameron's job as Prime Minister, was to get into the lobby at the last possible moment and leave at the earliest possible moment. My job was to get in there early before him and literally drag and pin him to the wall so he would listen to me, which, to his credit, he did.
How does David Cameron compare to Theresa May? You've worked alongside both of them. From a perspective of a foreign correspondent who covers them almost daily, they seem like polar opposites. David Cameron seemed to really enjoy the job. Theresa May, frankly, at times looks like she would rather be anywhere else but number 10. How do they compare in terms of their personality and their approach to being Prime Minister?
Well, they are hugely different. Now, I may be doing both of them an injustice, but this is a view I think you will find is generally well held. David Cameron enjoyed being Prime Minister, you're absolutely right. He was natural. He had the personality and the charm that went with the job. And he also was able to lead a government and give the country strong leadership. There's no question of that. When it came to his work ethic, I would say he was probably more Ronald Reagan in his ability to delegate and actually enjoy himself and have time for himself. The contrast is, whilst Theresa May doesn't actually have many of the interpersonal skills that David Cameron has, and frankly, she is facing the hugest job in politics at the moment, which is managing Brexit, she does have a work ethic that I would say is as good as, if not better than, even the great Margaret Thatcher. So you have got complete contrast. David Cameron, he was brilliant at the interpersonal skills. He would make you feel very special, all except on one occasion with me when we were talking. Whereas Theresa May is just wants to get on and do the job done and has no real interpersonal skills that you would expect to find in a politician. She wanted this job. She went for it. She won it. And then she made what was a dreadful call on the election, as it turned out. And now she's there, though, in many places, because of the party political weakness of the Conservatives, is that actually to swap leaders and have a new Prime Minister now would be a huge challenge. It could bring more division. It could bring down the government. When it comes to the leadership and fighting the government's case, yes, you know, she's not the best person to go out there and do that from her own personal skills. But that's why I look very closely at her reshuffle. And I see in the two new chairmen, the chairman she's appointed, Brandon Lewis, and the deputy chairman, James Cleverly, they are fighters. You will see more of them on television than anything else over the next year, 2 years, because they will be fighting it. They will be keeping her above the flak. And my guess is that what you'll see is a much more politically aggressive Conservative Party rather than letting Labour just get away with it, which is what's happening at the moment. I mean, I was pretty cross after the last election because, let's face it, it was a catastrophe in so many respects. And this isn't just hindsight. Many of us were on the phone to Central Office.
So, what were you saying?
Well, we were saying we're talking to the wrong people. The canvassing is not right, which was true. And it was a very centrally controlled election. Now, I think as a result, we were collecting the wrong data, and all the pollsters, including our own, were probably not picking up this huge shift in vote or the new vote that was coming from the younger generation, because normally they discount that. But that was more about the mechanics of the campaign. Then you had the leadership issues. We invested everything in strong and stable relating to Theresa May. The minute that wobbled, that meant your campaign was on the back foot. So there were all sorts of issues that, if you like, made us angry, frustrated, or whatever. But Jeremy Corbyn's closeness to victory could also be a wake-up call for many Conservatives who didn't turn out to vote. Many people, the whole idea of him being Prime Minister, particularly to older generations, is not something they would entertain. And the fact that he's been close to power, could have grasped power, I think is something that will actually help us next time round, assuming Jeremy Corbyn is leader of the Labour Party.
Was Boris wrong to bottle it? Should he have stood up and fought in that leadership contest?
No, he was right not to stand when Michael Gove had his about face, because I think it would have been impossible for him to go into a leadership election where someone who was his working hand in glove with him has turned around and said, I don't think he'd make a good leader. Huge mistake by Michael on that, I think. It was unfortunate, but times moved on. Boris did the right thing by pulling out at that point.
Some parliamentarians say Boris's abilities are underestimated. Others, though, say his abilities are overestimated.
Look, I think
Look,
have I ever seen Boris run his hands through his hair to ruffle up his hair to be consistent with an image? Yeah, of course I have. But actually, what I think people quite like about Boris, particularly his so-called gaffes, which I'm never convinced they are, I think they like that hints at that authenticity we're talking about. I mean, he is a clear conservative. He argues for those values consistently in what he does. And I think he's been very consistent on the minute he committed finally to the Brexit argument in the EU. I think he's been consistent and taken headcomers on. So he is not a fool, but he appeals, even now, after a divisive referendum, he cuts across where other politicians don't.
Do you think you'll ever be Prime Minister?
I think that if you are... I'll tell you what, this is a really tough one. If there was a leadership change, which I don't think there will be before 2020, then I think he has a very good chance. But my instincts tell me that Theresa May is going to stay in there a long time, do what our Michael Howard did, who was leader of our party for a while, is that he set up David Cameron to become leader and George Osborne to come. And I think Theresa May will have her eye on the succession coming from beyond those senior ranks in her cabinet.
As a somewhat successful backbench rebel, what would your advice be to Australian MPs who have a real opportunity, given the numbers currently in the House of Representatives, to flex some backbencher muscle?
If you choose to defy the whip, be proud of that, embrace that, because as a backbencher, you have considerable influence, particularly if you're a slightly grumpy one and prepared to stand up and be counted on issues that genuinely matter to you. It is about not overplaying your hand, because if you become just the regular nutter who's always rebelling, no one's going to listen to you. And it's never really vote against, you know, I never voted against my own manifesto, but if something new came up, I used my judgment. I went in thinking the way to get things done was to be a minister. I left realizing that actually, as a backbencher, I was more fulfilled. I think my constituents got a better deal, although they didn't seem to recognize that at the election. And what's more, I did manage to bring about change. So, you know, whatever you think you're going into, be prepared for your institution of parliament, your own party, and the media. They have other plans for you.
Nick Dubois, thank you very much for your time. From a very busy Liverpool Street station, we're looking forward to welcoming you to Australia in the next few days. Thanks again for your time.
Thank you very much. Good to see you, Brett.
SBS acknowledges the Ngunnawal people, who are the traditional custodians of the land on which the Australian Parliament sits and where this program was recorded. We pay respect to the elders of the Ngunnawal Nation, both past and present.